You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestagelessepodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, but they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's bastienhughes.com, or Instagram, Bastien Hughes. The first five people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to bastienhughes.com, because many, many times we can get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we've created and then just think, well, what's next, what now? Well, bastienhughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
He used to drive me to these rehearsals and take me to like urban gospel choir. My dad is of Nigerian descent. He was the one who opened me up to these other communities in Liverpool, that, you know, the black communities in Liverpool and that heritage and that culture. We've had one narrative for so long. It's hard to branch out from that. So I feel like for me, Northern, queer, mixed race, you know, androgynous / male / non-gender conforming artist who looks like me and is doing the sound that I'm doing. I'm in a really unique position.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. Today we are joined by songwriter, dancer, actor and producer Andro, most notable for performing as backing singer and iconic mover in Jungle, who's going to share experiences of playing the likes of Glastonbury, Jimmy Kimmel and later with Jules Holland. We'll be discussing the new solo EP Mortal and how being part of the Royal Shakespeare Company shaped Andro's approach to high profile performances. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Andro. Thanks for joining us today, Andro. How's it going?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So it's been a bit of a tricky year or so. So we're recording this as we go into August 2021. Just as a sliding doors moment, if COVID hadn't have happened, how would the last year have played out for you? And as it did happen, how has it played out in comparison?
That is a hard question. I don't really have the right answer. I don't really know how it would have played out. It was all pretty unpredictable and felt quite sudden. I was in LA in February 2020, and the whole like conversation around COVID and stuff was happening, but it wasn't like commonplace. So I was blissfully just enjoying myself in the sun and writing music and meeting new people. And then I came back to London to do a BBC intro show. And then within a week, it was just like COVID, virus, lockdown, and then we just went into this lockdown and stuff. And I'm sure at the time I had many, many plans to do things or perform, but it just kind of all fell apart. But I'm sure if it didn't happen, then you know, I'd just be writing and producing and working on my project, basically. But I think what's really important to note is that during that pandemic, I wrote my EP. And I think if that pandemic and lockdown didn't happen, then would my EP Mortal have ever been birthed at all? I know that some of the songs on there, two of which I had already written prior to the lockdown, but would it have manifested into what it was? Had the lockdown not have happened, then I have no idea. Probably not.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it was as difficult as it was for everyone. And, you know, every person listening to this would have been impacted in some way. You know, we have had a lot of people on the podcast say that it was a kind of a fresh opportunity to channel some creativity during that time because there was no other distractions, there wasn't other things to do. So it's kind of great in a way that in some ways it actually was a fast track to you releasing your EP. I'm quite interested. I mean, with this EP, I've listened to it like a number of times this week. Can you talk about like who you worked with on it and who produced it? Was it self-produced? And what you were trying to achieve by doing this EP?
So I produced this EP with one of my main collaborators called Matthias Bowman, who is a really great musician and producer. And some of the song, I mean, I think on a whole, the songs are really sentimental and have place in terms of like about my father, friends, lovers and family and the relationship to myself. So the EP is really about the relationships that we all have, whether that be friends, family, lovers or whatever, and the relationship to the self, but also just a reminder of how human we are and how mortal we are. So that was basically the whole idea behind the EP.
Let's talk about the way you fell in love with me. 7 months I can hardly breathe. I'm not a big believer in destiny. I know it's hard, I can't hide how I feel. Let's move on, hit the road. There's more to life than us. You know you mean a lot to me, but I'm sorry that I made your world go 360.
Yeah, it's a great listen. It's 13 minutes long and it's so melodic. I mean you can write some tunes, man. Like there's so many great going on crammed into those 13 minutes. Now you grew up in Liverpool, is that right?
Yes, I did.
One of my favourite places in the world. And I just wondered, like growing up in Liverpool, how that place shaped you in any way at all, particularly around music, or was you know your musical influences at a young age coming from a complete...
I think growing up, I listened to a lot of 80s stuff and a lot of Motown. So I think the 80s aspect has definitely influenced my music style. There's just something that I feel was very sincere about 80s music, and it was all in the feels, and there's something sonically about the sounds and stuff that they use in that era that just resonate with me, I guess, as opposed to now where it's very, I would say it's more digitalized and, dare I say it, a bit more generic and playlistable in a way, whereas in the 80s they kind of just like, they were just all in their feels, and they, you know, they did these big tunes and big moments and long vocals, and it wasn't always how amazing and how intricate you can play an instrument or how many riffs you can do with your voice. So, yeah, I think that answered your question.
It does. And actually, the interesting thing about the riffs of your voice, that's a, you know, we're talking about melismas here and you know, the classic kind of Christina Aguilera way of singing the American National Anthem, which you might have heard, which is put in so many different notes that don't exist, which is a thing that's come about a lot in the last 20 years. And if you look at people like Michael Jackson in the 80s, like they did a little bit of that and it was subtle, but it was nowhere near what it is now. And I think that's a really, really good point to make. What person, both, you know, it could be a musician or someone you knew, what person do you think has shaped you to where you are now more than any other person?
Good question. I think musically, I think the artists that probably shaped me are people like Björk, Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, just to name some of the biggest. I think it's only because they seem to have such a strong sense of self and owned their field and their craft and their identity and their style 100%, and Bowie as well. So I think that really just shaped who I am today. And also in terms of, funnily enough, their kind of androgyny and mixture of like femininity and masculinity, which I think I embodied growing up and still embody today. So I think that really shaped me. But I think also my parents, more so my dad, who really taught me about being persistent and how important music and art in general.
And I'm actually wearing a David Bowie t-shirt as you actually say that. And yeah, Bowie and Michael Jackson, particularly like that line around kind of androgyny is really, really interesting. And they really wore that on their sleeves. And I can imagine for a young person growing up, that would be really, really influential and important. I guess many of these artists you might have not have had an opportunity to ever see live because you were quite a young person. Did you ever, I guess you never saw Michael Jackson or anyone like that?
Yeah, all three of those, MJ, Whitney and Prince, I never got to see. And now they've all sadly passed away.
I was very lucky. The first concert I ever went to, I was only 5 years old, was Michael Jackson on the Bad Tour at Wembley Stadium. And it's, you know, I'm very lucky to have gone to many, many gigs in my life. But the hysteria that day was off the charts. It was the tour. I'm not, you're probably familiar with it. He did 7 nights at Wembley Stadium and Princess Diana arrived for one of them. And there were people fainting in the front row. And it was hysteria. It was, felt like someone like the Pope was in town or something like that. It was just this complete hysteria coming down. And his shows were amazing. And a really interesting story is that he would allow people to come on stage and sing Man in the Mirror as part of like people coming on at the end. And I was actually very lucky to be someone asked to do that. And I was frightened of him because of the Thriller video. And I was only 5 years old. So I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And I could have sung Man in the Mirror on stage of Michael Jackson, but there we go. Never mind. Yeah. Great artist. Okay. So in regards to, you know, again, growing up in Liverpool, you know, very early age, you've done some amazing things. You've done some stuff, interesting stuff in the theatre world. Obviously the stuff you've done with Jungle. I'm interested also in, you know, you're incredibly like stylish, right? So whenever we, you know, see you play with Jungle, I've been to see, you know, Jungle a number of times. You stand out in silhouette. And I don't know if you've ever heard that concept that if someone stands out in silhouette, it's really iconic and you really stand out in silhouette. So who influenced your kind of style and the idea about, okay, how are we going to be looking in silhouette and the hat and all that kind of thing?
So I think the whole silhouette thing with Jungle was firstly just to kind of hide the identities and that the identities were not important. That was mainly like a Tom and Josh thing. Like I have no problem showing my face. But actually the whole hat fedora thing was totally an accident because I'd not wore at the very beginning of performing with Jungle at all. And then we had a festival in Paris and it was the We Love Green festival. And we performed, and then after we performed, we went out to watch Lord. And this guy approached me and Rudy behind us and was like, oh, you guys were in Jungle, like you were great, you were really great. And that guy was Lucas Bravo, who is currently in the series Emily in Paris, and he plays Gabriel the cook. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Very, very handsome man. And so we got talking, and he was wearing this hat. And I was like, oh, I really want to wear one of those hats. I just felt like exploring my look a little bit more. And he was very complimentary. And then me and Rudy kind of went off. And then he ran after us and he was like, you can have it. And just gave me his hat. So that's how basically me and Lucas became friends. And then ever since then, I was wearing hats on stage, but they just got increasingly bigger and bigger over time with Jungle. So then by the time, you know, we were touring and the whole silhouette was like such a thing, I think that was like the most recognizable aspect of my appearance.
Have you still got that?
I don't think I do. Oh, wait. No, I don't actually. No, I don't have it. No, I've had so many now that they kind of, I'm kind of sick of them.
So, I mean, before you joined Jungle, obviously you've done a lot of really interesting stuff in the theatre world and obviously a lot of studying around performing arts and that kind of thing. What do you think, having seen that kind of side of the world and then obviously gone touring festivals and very much in the music industry side of things, do you think there's things that musicians, young musicians who've done nothing in theatre or, you know, performing arts studies could kind of learn or, you know, research or support themselves to really thrive in high pressure environments? Because you've gone on to play like Jimmy Kimmel and Ellen and Jules Holland, that kind of thing. Do you think it's something that can be learned? And do you think that helped prepare you for, you know, the gigs you've done with Jungle and your solo career?
I don't think you can learn a lot of it. I think you really have to be in the midst of it all. It's an experience that you can't really learn or read about in books properly. There's so much that goes into it I never knew before, and I've learned so much, and I've definitely learned a great deal of musicianship from the rest of the band, and how integral. I mean, obviously, growing up being in, you know, theatre productions and stuff like that, you kind of get a sense of how important and how integral the crew is as well anyway. So I guess I had, but you really do see the powers that surround you to make these events happen. But I think all of that I've learned engaged throughout the years touring with Jungle has only set me up and given me the foundations to do that as a solo artist.
And when you are doing one of these really high profile gigs, what do you need to be in place to feel really kind of confident and assured on that day, either kind of technically from a sound check point of view, but also how to use up that, not nervous energy, but that energy on the day of a big performance, maybe that?
I think what's just really important is knowing that the team around you are, one, very professional, very passionate about what they're doing, and that everyone gets on. I think there's just a really important energy that you need to have amongst your team in order to feel confident and secure and safe in what you're doing. So those really high profile jobs that we've done on TV or, you know, headlining festivals, and when you just know and feel that the whole team around you and the band around you are all essentially as one, then obviously you'll still have nerves because you want it to go right, but there's always that little bit of energy in the back that's kind of like, I know exactly what I'm doing, everyone else knows exactly what they're doing, we've got this.
It definitely exudes that, because it's really interesting from an outsider looking at the band, and, you know, a gig that I came to that was really interesting, one you did in Brixton when you came back. It was the first one you came back and did in Brixton. And if you look at performances like Jules Holland, when you get that fantastic camera shot that kind of pans from left to right, you really feel that they're kind of a cohesive gang of people who've got each other's back. And I'm not just saying that because you've said that. It's really, really palpable. So it's interesting that that isn't a front and it's fake. That's actually really genuine, because it's really kind of palpable from the front. Okay. Tell us about something that's gone wrong at a live show, and how did you deal with it?
Something that went wrong. I mean, I can't really remember of anything that went wrong. I mean, I'm sure there were, but maybe they kind of kept it from the rest of the band. The only thing that I can think of, I mean, there's definitely been times when, like, the in-ears have cut out, or you can't hear a certain instrument or vocal, and then you're kind of just like standing there, and this is like that. I don't think that's ever happened on TV, but definitely at festivals and at venues something goes wrong in the in-ears, and then you're kind of just like, you can't really stop the whole show, so you just have to carry on. There's definitely been a few moments when I've, you know, can't hear my vocal, but I had to keep like almost miming to a sense for like, you know, a second or two, and then as soon as you get the opportunity, you just wave to the monitors guy or whatever, or shout back in the shout back mic and be like, my ears don't work, help me, and then someone runs over and changes. I remember one time that Rudy, the other singer, and she wasn't feeling too well, and she was such a trooper and a soldier, she ran off stage and threw up. And then she just came back on and continued performing, and that's what it's about. That's it. Champion.
Awesome. Great stuff. So let's talk about you in the studio and, you know, the stuff that you've been writing. Can you give any examples of techniques you've either used as a producer with someone else or someone's used with you that has really kind of got the best out of you? So, you know, we all know about red light syndrome, et cetera, et cetera. So what's something that you've seen or experienced that you really felt accentuated someone's opportunity to absolutely smash their vocal performance or whatever it might be?
Mood and environment is really important to me personally. So if I get into the studio and we don't, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of musicians who say this, that especially when you're working with someone new, if you don't have a kind of like general vibe and a chat before you start working together, that could be like an hour or two before you start working. It's so important to just get the energy flowing between you and the, you know, other artist or producer. A lot of the time, I don't really like other lyricists, writers in the room, especially on the first day. I don't know how common this is, but I just personally don't really like it. I know exactly what I want to say sometimes, and that might not happen on the day. It might happen if I take the track home and just like zone in a dark room by myself. Sometimes I do that. But sometimes in a session, I'll just be like super, super quiet. And I'll be just like going through all these lyrics and stuff in my head and melodies. And then because I prefer to write with pencil and paper rather than typing, because I think there's a really nice, elegant flow that happens from brain to pencil or pen. And I'll just be in my own world. And then sometimes I'll have this writer like, ooh, yeah. And like just honestly, just really, really distracting. So now when I go into the studio, if I'm working with someone new, I'll be like, I don't want a writer in the first session, like that can come later, because I might just come up with the whole song on the day. But there are some times when I've been in a few sessions and I vibed with a writer so much, so I'm more than happy to write with them again, but I am very selective. But yeah, mood and ambiance is really important. Like, I love if the studio is a little bit quirky and they've got candles and lights and crystals and anything witchy and stuff like that.
What are you thinking about when you're doing a vocal take? Are you thinking about the lyrics? Are you doing like a running commentary in your head thinking, oh, last verse, I could have done that better, or actually this is a really good take, so I don't want to mess up the rest of this? Like, where are you? What's your brain doing whilst you're performing like a really, really, you know, amazing take?
All of those things that you've just said. All of those things. I mean, sometimes you might just lay down a rough vocal where you're literally just riffing gibberish. And if something sticks, then you go with that. And if some words come to your head, then you go with that. Or you write the lyrics first and then and the melody, and then you lay it down. But sometimes when you're in the moment, new things kind of just like impulsively come to your head, and then you surprise yourself sometimes when you're recording the vocal. But yeah, sometimes I'll be like, okay, scrap that, I want to do it again. Or even if your body isn't feeling quite right, sometimes you just gotta, you know, navigate the space. There were so many warnings. You left me guessing. I should have known it all from the start. I fought for the silence, but it was so deafening. Yet I could hear. This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
Fucking one.
Most songwriters are perfectionists, so. How do you get to the stage where you're happy to kind of like go, right, that's it now. We're not going to do anything more to this. I'm not going to put any more instruments on. We're not going to do more, like, you know, harmonies, backing vocals, or we're not going to do any other mixes of this. This is done. That can be quite a difficult stage to get to because we're kind of a bit too close and precious with it. So how do you sign something off and go, right, that's it? Or does someone else do that? Do you give that responsibility to someone else?
If it's lyrics, that can take a while, only because if I'm working on by myself lyric-wise, then I just know exactly what I want to say, so it's very specific to me. If there's like one line or one word that just doesn't feel right, for me it's just all about how it feels, especially when I'm singing it. So there's some words that might be the right word to use, but they don't sing well, so then you have to change it. Sorry, I've kind of forgotten the question now.
No, that's fine. I mean, you know, it's just a really interesting to get into the mindset of someone who is recording and how they can kind of sign off. You know, I've done mixes in the past of stuff where it's like I've got a mug actually, which is brilliant, which is, says like audio final mix final. This is the last fucking version I'm ever gonna do. Dot. You know, it's just like, how do we actually do the final mix and sign it off? You know, maybe we need a deadline or something. I don't know what works.
Yeah, I think targets and deadlines do help. There is always a moment where you've just got to be like, I've got to leave this now and put it away, especially when it comes to mixing, because I don't mix. I'm terrible at mixing. There's people who enjoy that thoroughly and they can happily have the track to mix. But I obviously have an input into that. So, yeah, there does need to be a time... There needs to come a point where I've just got to leave the mix alone. But in terms of production and lyricism, that all has to, like, feel right as much as possible to me, sonically, emotionally, mentally, physically. And then, you know, I tackle the mix, but then, yeah, there needs to be a point where the mix has just got to be like, okay, I don't mix. Someone has got a particular extra ear for mix so they can, like, take care of it. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. And actually, it's interesting because listening to all of your kind of back catalogue of stuff that you've done, one constant theme I felt throughout most of it, and you touched upon this earlier, was that the lyrics are very kind of about personal relationships. And it's really, really, it's almost like an intimacy. You're sharing your kind of personal relationships with the listener. Is that a conscious effort, or is that just something that automatically, you know, that's just the first thing that, you know, comes to you when you got your pen and paper there? And have you thought about writing about other things in future? And like, could that well dry up at some point? And how do you feel about writing about the things that aren't so personal?
I definitely do write some things that aren't personal. I think it just depends on the song. There's only been less than a handful of people who I've written really deep things with. And they're always so accommodating about what I'm trying to say, but they help bring out things in me that I might not necessarily see or feel in terms of words and whatever. But yeah, it can be tricky.
When you meet people outside of the music industry, what's the one thing that would surprise them most about the reality of the music industry?
It's never as glamorous as people think it is at all. Like, you have to create some sort of superhero skill to be able to sleep anywhere and everywhere. Touring is so hard. I absolutely love touring. I've had the time of my life touring, and I, you know, really want to continue doing that for the rest of my life. But it is really hard, and it's not as glamorous as people think. You know, going through airports and airport fumes and security and different time zones and all of that, it's really, really draining and taxing mentally and physically on the body. So it's really hard. But the kind of like end all event of that is the show. And you kind of forget about all of that when you're on stage and you meet fans and you meet other people in the industry.
It's super interesting because Fraser talked about this from Jungle in quite a lot of depth and pretty much said exactly the same as what you did. It sounds like some of the touring you've done, yeah, sounds really, really challenging. How do you personally, you know, stay, you know, as kind of centered throughout that? Do you do anything? Are you like a yoga person, or are you someone who needs space to themselves? Do you need to be around other people? Like, how do you navigate that so that you can, you know, perform your best in the evening when the gig comes?
I'm like an ambivert. So I'm like introvert, extrovert, but I'm definitely more introvert. Extrovert when it comes to music and stuff, but introvert when it comes to other people. So touring with a band and crew of like 14 people in total, 24/7, literally 24/7 for, you know, months on end, is so difficult. It's amazing because it's like a huge family, but it's so difficult. There was definitely times when I was like, I cannot be around any person right now. I need to just go off on my own. If that's just like, you know, you end up in Chicago and then you just want to like go for breakfast on your own and you don't even know where you are, like that happens. And it's not because you hate anybody, it's just because the energies are so like big and you just need to like recalibrate. That's for me anyway. But also, yeah, I do exercise and I do yoga and I meditate a lot. And I think for me, yoga and, well, meditation is like super, super important to stay mindful and balanced. And that can help with the physical attributes of yourself as well as mental.
I'm fascinated that you say that you're an introvert. or you know, I think you said Ambi, right? So it's because if you were to go on your Instagram and, you know, just, I've never met you, but like obviously seen you from afar, jungle gigs and stuff like that, that surprises me. So I guess the question brings me on to the next question I had, which was, who do you feel you become on stage that you aren't so much off stage? What part of your personality becomes more accentuated, if you like, when you move on
to- I think it's just the need and want to express, because I'm an artist and I'm an actor and a performer. So, you know, since a very, very young age, I've always just wanted to, like, express myself, whether that be vocally or through my body. So when I'm on stage, that's how I communicate whatever's going on in my life or how I'm feeling or how I'm trying to portray a story of something else. But then off stage, obviously depending on who I'm with, but predominantly most of the time, I'm an introvert. And I think that does surprise people because my social media is very extroverted and, you know, can be quite in your face in a good way, hopefully. And I love to make people laugh as well. But when people meet me, they're like, wow, you're really chill, which really does surprise people. But I hear it all the time. They say that I'm such a calm, chill person. But there's definitely moments, you know, when I'm with, I think it just depends on if I really know you well enough that I can be very funny and loud, but I'm chill most of the time.
If I could somehow give you the opportunity to be in the audience of a gig you've played in the past, to experience it from an audience's point of view, which gig would you choose?
One of my own gigs or with Jungle or both?
Let's take one of each.
Oh, hard. Glastonbury was a pretty special moment, I think, for everyone and for me. Also, Alexandra Palace. So these were both with Jungle. Those were like two massive shows, and there was like an insane amount of love being exchanged between audience and band. For me, I've done like lots of little shows, but I think there's one in particular where I was doing Ronnie Scott's and I had like my whole band with me, but we kind of done a stripped back thing, and there was loads of friends and family there and stuff, but there was also a lot of people who I didn't know, and I just remember that one very vividly. It was several years ago, but there was an insane amount of love there as well and appreciation. I think maybe it's just the venue as well. Ronnie Scott's is one of those places where people who go there really love to like listen to live music and support the artists there. I've not been in there in a long time, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely a captive audience in Ronnie Scott's. Yeah, they're two great answers. Thank you. What underrated skill do you think every musician or performer should have? It could be technical or it could be kind of a life skill to really kind of navigate the music industry.
Oh, interesting question.
Underrated skill.
Instantly, when you said that, I kind of thought of meditation, which sounds like the most... sounds like the most pompous answer, but I do really think that it's quite integral to just because it is a difficult industry to navigate, you know, even when you're not touring, like upcoming artists and artists who are like on the precipice of like breaking in terms of breaking into the industry mainstream can be really such a hard slog. And if you haven't got some sort of like mindfulness going on or another avenue, for me, yes, it is meditation, but it's also acting. If you haven't got that other avenue to like offload onto, then it can be incredibly hard. And that's why there's so many people in this industry who have a hard time with mental illness and stuff.
It's interesting because a lot of musicians who listen to this who are kind of, as you say, on the precipice of breaking, et cetera, et cetera, one of their biggest challenges right now is the role their parents play, as in whether the parents are kind of backing them and say, just go for it. Or they're saying, not much money in the music industry, in the streaming days, don't really think there's much of a career in that. And how that influences them, whether they listen to them or not, or even subconsciously that influences the decisions they then make going forward. What were your parents' role in that, if you're happy to share? And did you, you know, when Fraser answers this, the kind of answer was they fully backed me, but also said, make sure you've got something else in the back pocket in case it doesn't work out, you know, that kind of thing, which is interesting. What about your parents? How did they support you?
My parents have always been so supportive of me doing, and they've never said to me anyway that make sure I should have something in my back pocket. They just, I guess, always saw and could feel that I was 100% wanting to be a musician and an actor. That never faltered. Yeah, I think it can be obviously environment and upbringing and your parents' stance on that can be really important, but mine were always so supportive.
And it's, you know, for anyone listening to this, I've got a manual just to the left of me. I'm a what's known as a Mental Health First Aid England trainer, and something I do away from this. And a really interesting thing is that a way of avoiding mental health challenges later on in life is to be exposed to arts and culture as a young person. That's actually like there's a direct link between that. So that's like a really, really interesting element. Mick Jagger once said that his biggest fear was losing his voice. What do you do to look after your voice?
I do vocal warm-ups like nearly every morning. I tell you though that during the lockdown it was very hard to want to do a vocal warm-up, even though I was working on the EP and stuff. Once that was kind of completed and I was like mixing it and sorting out photo shoots and blah 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 blah, if I could because of lockdown, there was a really long period where I wasn't singing at all, and I wasn't even warming up. There'd be times when I'd be like singing, you know, in the shower or whatever, but I really wasn't expressing my voice to its full potential, I guess. And there was one Sunday where I was just sitting at my desk, and it was a gorgeous day outside, and I literally just started weeping. I was just crying because I was trying to sing something or listening to something and trying to sing it. And I was like, I feel like my voice has like changed so much over the course of a year. And I, you know, I remember calling my friends and that, because I never really like talk about I never offload onto people that much. I deal with it quite a lot, but I've no problem expressing my emotions and being vulnerable. But I've always been very self-sufficient. But I was calling up my friends and I was like, my voice has changed so much. I can't sing anymore. What's going on? So that was really, really hard. But I got through it.
Was that just because you hadn't been doing the warm-ups? Do you think, was that just, in your opinion, was that just a result of you not doing the warm-ups each day that temporarily happened?
I think it was a mixture of not doing the warm-ups, my self-saboteur just trying to kill me off, and not being able to perform live. And obviously when you're in an apartment where there are neighbours and stuff, like, I sing loud and I like to sing loud. So there was also just that sense of, like, not fully being able to sing all the time. Like, I want to be able to sing at, like, 2 or 3 a.m., full voice, and not worried about people moaning at me. So, yeah, it was a mixture of both things, I think, from that.
Big question now. Is the music industry fair? And the second part to that is, if you were for a day kind of president of the music industry, what laws would you create to make the industry more fair?
Is the industry fair? No, not one bit. There is like the thing about the music industry and the acting industry is that you almost can't, you know, there's no guarantee if you do a degree in like music and stuff. It is really about how you navigate in that world and who you meet. I don't think talent has got anything to do with it anymore. I don't even think that you have to be able to sing to be a star these days. You could just be a really good producer and lay over a really terrible lazy vocal over it and people will still love that, which is great. But I'm not one of them. I'm a singer. But yeah, nothing can really prepare you at all.
What's the most important piece of kind of memorabilia you've picked up along the way? So something to do with music, perhaps, or performing, that, you know, if the house or your place was burning down and everyone was safe, etc., etc., what's the thing that you'd grab?
If the house was burning down?
Yeah.
My laptop and hard drives.
So it's all the music's on there, is it?
Yeah, everything is on there. That's it. without a shadow.
Do you have anything that's like anything that's, you know, you picked up along the way, passes or to gigs or anything like that, that's brings back a bit of nostalgia, or is that not you?
If you're lucky enough, then sometimes a venue will like gift the artist like a mug or a t-shirt or something.
Well,
I haven't got any of those. So no, I haven't really picked anything up over the years. Like, I might have like a little t-shirt or hoodie from a festival or a venue or something, but I don't really have much like sentimental attachment to them. I just kind of remember the experience and the feeling that it gave me, and photos and videos.
Yeah. Which are all online now anyway. So yeah, that's good. If you were to find out the world was ending tomorrow, what would be your biggest musical regret?
My biggest musical regret if the world was ending tomorrow. I don't know if I have one. I don't know if I have one, actually. I think I've done everything. I mean, now that I've released the EP and the songs on there that are mean very, very much to me, now that they're like out open into the world, if the world was ending tomorrow, I'd be like, okay, I've released my EP. Yeah, it had some stuff on there that was like about people that meant a lot to me. And I put my heart and soul into it, so I'm okay if the world ends tomorrow. But I've got so much more to do, so hopefully it doesn't end.
So what's the plan? I mean, you know, what are your other ambitions or motivations going forward? Obviously, you know, there's a lot that you want to do with your solo career. What do you see that kind of plan to look like? And, you know, is there a plan of how frequently you want to release new stuff? Is it going to be quite spaced out? Like, is it just going to be impulsive? You know, you've written something, so I'm going to put it out there. Or is it going to be strategic? Like, what's your plan going forward? Have you got one?
Yeah, I think what I've learned over the last couple of years and now over this whole period is that being prolific isn't a bad thing. Not every piece of work that you're going to put out is going to be amazing or a chart stopper, but it's just a case of expression. So for me, I'm definitely going to be working on an album now. That might change in, you know, the next year or so. I know that before I released the EP Mortal, I was going to release two parts, and then the second part just didn't work, so I didn't do that. So it's just the one EP. So, but for now, I'm going to be working on an album. I'm not going to be shy in saying that I'm absolutely going for gold, and I want to like reach heights that, you know, I don't tell a lot of people what those are, but I know exactly where I want to be, and I really am going for gold. Yeah, I mean, like, I want to be touring the world, and I want to do arena performances, and I wouldn't want to do that unless I know that I could. So that's what I plan to do.
Well, you got the tunes, you got the look, and you got the voice. So you're going to be opening for Jungle in some upcoming shows. How are you feeling about that?
So I will be just doing Andro, opening the show on the 2nd of September.
It's great that you know that you're getting the opportunity to do that. You know, that's cool.
Follow us on Instagram at the Stage Left Podcast, where you'll see behind the scenes photos from our interviews with members of Oasis, Queen, and Madness.
You know, we talk a lot about what advice we would, you know, pass on to other people. What's the best bit of advice someone's given you, Andro?
The best advice that I've received was definitely from my parents, which was just that persistence is key. Resilience and persistence, that's what they taught me, that's the advice that they gave me, and that's what I have navigated throughout my life, moving from Liverpool to London, and that's what I'll continue to do. I think that's just really important. Believing in yourself is paramount, and not making music that you think other people will like. Obviously, you want people to like your music and love your music. People will, and some people won't. But the point is to do what resonates with you first.
Thank you for sharing. What classic stories have you got that you'll be telling your grandchildren maybe one day? What's the stories that the, you know, from touring that was just, you know, the surreal moments? What's the most surreal moment you've experienced touring?
The most surreal moment? There's been so many. There's been so many that it almost kind of just blends into one. I think touring with Jungle was definitely a classic story that I'm going to tell. I don't know why, but I've just thought of this moment where we were touring Australia and then Asia, and we had like this very short gap in between, which we were all very angry about to management, etc., and the booking agent. But we were so, so tired, and I was so, so tired that we went to our hotel rooms for half an hour, and I tried to get like a little nap in there because then had to go to the festival venue to perform. And I was so disorientated that, and we were in our hotel rooms on our own, I was so disorientated that I almost fell and smacked my face into the corner of the table. And I just know I probably would have like seriously injured myself or killed myself. But I was just, it was serious, serious jet lag, to the point where like, that was the point where we were like, our health is kind of almost at risk here if we don't have proper rest, and it can get like that. So that's a little story I'd probably tell. Sorry, I feel like that's really lame, but don't know if I have any classic ones.
I mean it just highlights, doesn't it, you know, the importance of if with anything in life, you know, just to be in the right mindset to be able to do it. What's one song that you've recorded that if someone's never heard your stuff before, you direct them to, that you'd most want them to?
I think it would be my song Smoke, which is the first track on the EP. Because I wrote that at a time when I actually only wrote that in like, I started writing it in February when I was in LA. And I was just like at a loss. I felt like I wasn't able to write anything. So, and I was also in the midst of the campaign for one of my previous songs, Lost Cause, which was about the BLM movement. Well,
the production on that song is amazing. The production on Lost Cause is so interesting. It's so good.
Thank you very much. So I was kind of in the midst of that, but I was also doing The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe play at the Bridge Theatre in London. And even though I was working the campaigns for Give You My Heart and Lost Cause, there wasn't much like writing going on because I was also doing the campaign, but also in this play. And by the time I'd finished the play, I went to LA and I was like, I don't feel like I can write anything. Like, I'm not enjoying anything that I'm writing. And then Matthias sent me this really simple kind of melody, and the melody of the top line kind of came to me instantly. And I basically just started writing about like self-doubt, but also the idea of, because it's LA, getting high and kind of being one with your body in a sense. And the whole idea of like smoking to hear the voices was basically me trying to let go so that the creative genius would speak within me or to, in order for me to write. And then I basically wrote that song.
Thank you for sharing. It's interesting you said that's the first track on the EP. I thought it was the third track.
Yeah, well, you know, that's because management and whoever else has basically fucked it up. But it is supposed to be the first track on the EP. Basically, my manager like gave it to them wrong, so it's in the wrong order, and I was really, really pissed off about it, to be honest. But and it takes several weeks for them to like reorder it. I don't know. Like, they basically have to like, they have to give the whole like catalog of like the whole EP again, rather than just like going on a computer and shifting the songs around. I really don't understand why or how it works. But
listen, 360 is a banging tune to open with anyway, so I wouldn't worry about it too much. But I know what it's like as someone who's created that stuff. You want it to be exactly as you want.
Yeah, because it's like it's kind of like a sonic journey, like when you listen to it. And there is even though it's not immediately obvious to the listener, there is a story that I'm trying to tell with the EP. You know, starting off with Smoke, which is about like self-doubt and, you know, kind of, you know, getting high to find creativity. And then that song was born. And then I wrote 360, which I think is probably one of the biggest pop tunes that I've currently ever written. And then Fight Back was, you know, to do with my father. And then Best Friend was to kind of to do with a best friend that I'm no longer friends, but also tying into my relationship with my father as well. So there is a bit of a story that I'm trying to tell in that.
Are you allowed to explore, you know, the relationship with your father? I mean, everyone's got daddy issues, right? So, I mean, or would you like people to listen to the lyrics? I mean, is there anything particular, you know, that you want to discuss around that? You know, why was your father so apparent in regards to the lyrics for this?
Well, I think because my dad was such a poignant role in me as an artist. Like, he used to drive me to these rehearsals and take me to like urban gospel choir. And also because my dad is of Nigerian descent, he was the one who opened me up to these other communities in Liverpool, that, you know, the black communities in Liverpool and that heritage and that culture. So obviously that's one point, but then obviously because he passed away 5 years ago, like I'd not been able to write I started that song like pretty soon after he died, but wasn't able to finish it. And it was only last year during the lockdown that I was able to finish it and get it out there. So that's why.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. And I'm sure I'd be very proud of you. It's a great EP. And so the order we want people to listen to this in, right? So you said Smoke first, then 360, then Fight Back, and then Best Friend. Is that right? Okay, anyone listening now, right, that's the order we want. Okay, good stuff. Final question. What fears do you have for the music industry looking forward? And how might those fears be addressed?
Well, the first thing that came to my head was, okay, I'm going to be really frank with you. I don't think that there's anyone in the industry like me right now in terms of Northern, queer, mixed race, you know, androgynous / male / non-gender conforming artist who looks like me and is doing the sound that I'm doing. Yes, there might, yes, like America and Europe or whatever, like you've got your Miguel's and you've got your M&EK of the UK, etc. But you've also got like your Ollie Years and Years and your Troye Sivan's, but there's no one who looks like me. And I think even in the acting industry as well, I'm not seeing me represented. And I know that there's this whole idea of like, oh, people just want to see themselves represented in the industry and on TV and on film, etc. But I think because we've had one narrative for so long that it's hard to kind of like branch out from that. So I feel like for me, especially, I'm in a really unique position because there's no one in the industry like really like me right now in the UK, especially, that people aren't able to see it. But it's either going to be a really great thing or not, if that makes sense.
That's an amazing answer. Okay, so thank you so much, Andro, for your wisdom, your insight, your transparency. Good luck with the EP. It's great what I've listened to so far. We look forward to seeing you, you know, in those arenas at some point in the future. It's been fantastic to have you on the podcast, and thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
This episode was scored, mixed, and edited by Bastian Hughes, BASTIANHUES. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving an endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, BASTIANHUES. He's doing a great job.